All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 36 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're back after Thanksgiving, so I hope you had a nice break, and I certainly did, although unfortunately it ended up with me catching a cold, so my throat is pretty raw today, as I'm sure you'll be hearing on the recording. It's not the usual me. But anyway, I should be able to get by and be back to my normal self pretty soon. So anyway, today we're going to embark on this theme of the lead up to democracy. Right? We know, and we have anchored, in fact, beyond knowing, we have anchored our study of ancient history to the invention, the creation of democracy in Athens, circa 508 BC. And this is part of our map to the past. I called it a Portolan chart, right? Because it's our means of navigating from where we are today back to the knowledge that we are gaining, and therefore our means of being able to connect the two, and to make sure that we are not merely pursuing facts about the past and knowledge about things that happened a long time ago to other people, but rather pursuing knowledge that informs our awareness of the world around us. And that world includes, for instance, Americans who are feverishly preparing for another election. Right, so as you look around at American society and you see that the United States, in the way that its democratic aspects function, has organized into two political parties, and their candidates now are vying for the loyalty of their particular members of those parties, and then they are going to present themselves to the nation in a national election later in the new year, and one of those persons is going to be chosen president of the United States. All of these democratic activities, which are quite prevalent nowadays, normal essentially in the world rather than exceptional, all those types of things. I mean, where does that all come from? There really is only one place, and that is ancient Athens. So that is one of the reasons why we study ancient history. One of the absolute top reasons why we study ancient history is to find out about what the Athenians did to create democracy. What were their premises? What were they thinking of? How did they originate this? What did they think they were doing? What did they transmit to us? Why did their idea have such a persistence in the history of mankind, right? How come the idea that they thought of survived the way that it did? How did it become embedded in our culture such that we have this expectation that when we are going to form a government and the society that we live in is going to be ordered in a certain way, that we're going to vote to do that? And how did that come to be? And what does it stand for? And what does it say about us that we are so focused on that particular type of value and so on? Right? These are the types of questions that we're looking for answers to when we're studying ancient history. And so that's why we anchor our study of the ancient past to this particular milestone, Athens 508 BC. But what we're going to look at now is we're going to extend that story back a little bit further than we've done before. We now have another anchor that we talked about last week, which is the first Olympic Games, which marks the emergence of ancient Greece into history. We're going to look now at that period between those two anchors. We now have a good kind of concrete scope to use, or a set of boundaries to understand the progress that occurred in Athens that progress began around 776 and it culminated in 508. So we have a story here of progress over this time. It's a very bumpy road. It's a very torturous story of progress because it is the story of an archaic peoples. So we're still talking about archaic peoples here. The special thing that we're talking about, though, is archaic Greeks. So these were the people, as I introduced you to the idea last time, that were not happy with the archaic plateau, right? The ones that were not satisfied to be living in that very primitive state with the various characteristic features of a society that kept people stuck at that level of development and essentially unfulfilled as human beings because they had to live in such a way that it didn't really allow them to grow to that point, that flourishing quality that human nature is capable of attaining, that you right now are working towards through being educated and being raised by your parents and being educated and so on, to the point where you are able to stand on your own 2 feet in this world and do your own thinking and choosing and living and go out and pursue your happiness and have the best possible life that you can have. See, we have this Greek idea. It's now so commonplace in modern society. But the Greeks were the first to really aspire to that. The first to consider themselves worthy of more than what archaic life provided, and to want to have conditions to live in that would permit them to at least strive for that outcome. They didn't imagine a world of modern technology and science and all of that kind of stuff. They couldn't possibly have imagined such a thing. But what they understood, as we talked about last time, was that human beings have a certain nature. We are all of us thinking animals, or to use Aristotle's expression, rational animals, which means we have this faculty of reason. We have minds. And if we enact the process of thought in any particular area of our existence, the benefit is the ability to identify the world and to create values in that world that previously didn't exist, and to make life better. So that's what we call in modern times the pursuit of happiness. And the Greeks also had that same idea. And so this is what they're striving for in their archaic times. They're striving for conditions to improve the life of the rational animal and be able to live in a better way. How are they going to do that? By what steps did they finally get to the solution that they created anyway, the solution of democracy in their setting? That's the story of archaic Athens that we're going to study over the next few lectures here. How did they climb up beyond the archaic plateau to the next level to permit themselves to have that better life, or at least to strive to create it? All right, so what we need in order to understand this story is we need to have a clear picture of what life was like in Athens and what it was like pretty much in any of the in any part of Greece, right? And we already got oriented in some measure to some of the issues that are crucial here to understanding this. For instance, last time we talked about the fact that there's no Nile in Greece, right? There's no Tigris or Euphrates. There's no all-giving river. Greece was not the gift of any river, right? Greece was, relatively speaking, a harsh environment in which to for a civilization to arise. And that probably has something to do with why Greece didn't emerge 3000 BC, but rather didn't really get its start until 776. But basically, because of the conditions, because of the really, really mountainous terrain, all of the cities that you see labeled on this map, including Athens, which of course is going to be where we focus our attention today. I'm going to go ahead and put a rectangle around Athens. All right, so we have Athens and the region that it was in called Attica, which is also labeled there. So all of these various cities that you see labeled here were not merely cities. They were functioned on behalf of their citizens in a manner that we would more associate with countries today. In other words, Athens had its own army. And it was a citizen army, so, I mean, basically the male citizens were the army. But, you know, Athens had its army, and Corinth had its army, and Sparta had its army, and so on. Look on the map, you find a city. Basically, you're talking about an independent country. So, this is part one of the context here for grasping or understanding the story that we're going to see the evolution away from archaic monarchy towards democracy, is to focus on this context and what it was like to live in that situation. So what do we call that when you have a city that's a country? Right? This is vocabulary word number one for this context, Juliet.
City-state.
Say that again, please.
A city-state.
Okay, that was a little bit quiet, but I got it. City-state. Right? Okay, hyphenated term, city-state. Okay? Now, I want to get everybody here kind of thinking about life in a city-state. And in particular, I want you to be thinking about contrasts between modern cities and ancient cities so that you can kind of grasp what the social context was like in a place like this. So the first thing that I want to highlight in that regard is an important difference between cities back then and cities today. So, well, first let's start with a minor difference. Number one is they were a lot smaller than cities today. So in ancient, in 776 BC, I have no idea what the biggest city in the world would have been at that point. It might be that a city like Babylon or a city like Thebes in Egypt or something like that might have been, you know, maybe all the way up to 1 million people, but that would have been wildly exceptional. So nowadays, you know, we think of cities and a figure like 1 million people is just really nothing particularly special. It's just pretty much what we think of when we think of a city. We're talking about 1 million people and up. In big cities, more like 5 or 10 million people. So one thing to understand about the city-states back then, this is still a primitive level of development, and so they were much smaller. Within this entire rectangle that I've highlighted very kind of approximately, which was called Attica, the region surrounding Athens, within that entire area, the citizenry of Athens and all of its slave population as well, which was the majority of the people, so it would have totaled about 400,000 people. That's a rough estimate. Okay, we don't have any census data, and so we don't know exactly. But let's put it at a rough estimate: the entire population of the city-state at 400,000 people. All right, so let's get oriented to that here and what life would be like in that situation The first thing to understand about those 400,000 people is how closely connected they were compared to today. Right? So when I say city, and you think about the city that you're living in, just for a minute here, think about this. How many people do you know in the city? Assuming you're all living in a city or near some large city. Think about the numbers here that you're talking about here. Think about the size of the city that you live in. And then think to your, see if you can give me just a quick guess. It's obviously you don't have to be exactly right here. But how many people in the city that you live in do you know by name? How big is the city you live in? And how many people do you know by name? So, Theo, just give me an answer on your end.
Well, I think Seattle's probably several million, maybe 4 or 5. And then I know maybe 30 or 40 people by name.
Okay, right. Yeah, so metro area Seattle, if we're usually talking about that, right, probably is in a couple million people. And, you know, maybe 30 by name, right? That's a pretty good estimate. You know, it's dumps, different people have a different amount of contact with people, right? But, Abby, what about you?
Houston is a really large city, probably about the size of Seattle, that, like, about the size that Theo was describing for his city. And I know probably 10 people.
Right, exactly, right? Excuse me. and so you guys are young still, so you don't have the professional contacts that your parents will have, and people that they know by name for those reasons. So, but I suspect, you know, depending on what kind of job your parents have, they might know 100 people by name. And we're talking here, right? If you do the math, 100 people out of 4 million? So, excuse me. So, here's the term that I want to highlight for that strange feature of modern life, which probably we take for granted, but which is a condition that when you hear city, and when you think about your city and your personal life and your context, you've got to be able to get out of that context, right? You have to be able to enact what we call historical empathy. You've got to put yourself in the shoes of the Athenians and say, oh, that city was a whole other thing than the kind I'm thinking of, right? Because we live in modern times. Modern life, a city life, is anonymous. That's the key word that I want to bring up here. It's very anonymous. Nobody knows who you are, right? And so, you know, I mean, we treat each other civilly, and depending on what part of the country you're in, people are a little bit nicer than other places. And so on, right? But you know, you go to the grocery store and the clerk has a tag. You don't really know his name. It says his name or her name, right? And then but you don't really know that person. And you don't speak to them on a first name basis. And when you go to the gas station, you don't know the guy behind the counter, and so on and so forth, right? I mean, even in your neighbors. Think about how well you know your neighbors. Now, if you live in your parents' home and they've been there for many, many years, then probably over time they've developed relationship with their neighbors, and they know them, and you probably know quite a few of them by name. But the minute you go more than about 2 houses down, right? I mean, do you know those people? And in modern times, right? People are very mobile. and move around a lot. And so, you know, you go to the local U-Haul truck or storage space, and you look at the license plates on the trucks there. They're from all the other states in the country. And you know, just recently somebody, I live in an apartment building, and so next to us, you know, people moved in here from another state, and that's regular, that's normal. And we don't know them, and it's nice, we say hi to each other, and so we recognize each other, but we don't know each other. And so we live very anonymously. So that's modern life. But step one here in understanding Athenian life and the character of Athenian monarchy, even though it was an archaic way of life and it was an archaic system of monarchy, the level of intimacy, the level of connectedness between the people was much higher. So that anonymity did not exist. Now, here's something to think about, to try to grasp this context as well. Let's compare modern life, very anonymous, to Athens, the city-state, 400,000 people in this rectangle, and Egypt. So, what was Athens more like, and in what ways? Was it more like Egypt? This, you know, united Upper and Lower Egypt, and the pharaoh is in Upper Egypt, and you're a farmer living in Lower Egypt. Which one is that more like? Is Athens more like Egypt? Was it more like modern times, or which, you know, which one of these is more similar? I don't know if I'm putting the question in a very lucid manner here, but you get my point. I'm trying to raise this issue of anonymity and bring up a comparison here. Egypt, who knew the pharaoh? Let me put it that way. Right? Maybe you'll see what I'm driving at when I ask it that way. Who knew the pharaoh in ancient Egypt? Juliet?
Probably the maximum of around 6 people, I'd say. Depending on the amount of children he had.
Okay, right. Yeah, well, we're talking about, again, a very intimate circle, like the size of the number of people whose names you know is about the number of people who would have known the pharaoh. So in other words, right, what's that like? Right, it's, in a way, ancient Egypt and the pharaonic system was more like modern life, where the pharaoh had this anonymous existence. He wasn't connected to the people. He was very much separate. And so people didn't know him. And this is a part of the God-King myth, right? The ability to project this imagery of him as being separate from everybody else was because he was separate from everybody else. Right? The society was larger, and he maintained himself in isolation, and his family was in isolation from everybody else. So he had this anonymity. But in Athens, everybody was more closely connected to everybody else. And that's because, basically, the city, all of the citizens of the city belong to one big tribe of people. This is another key word that we have to work with here, the word tribe, and its connection to other, you know, kind of sub-concepts. A tribe is a group of clans, which is a group of, where am I looking? What's the smaller sub-unit here of this big idea? We go from one thing, we have individuals, and they belong to so on. And then you put those together and you get clans, and you put those together and you get a tribe. So what's the normal unit? What's the normal social unit that we're talking about here? Theo, go ahead.
Well, a family maybe?
Yeah, family, right? So a city like Athens was basically a big tribe, which means a group of related clans, which means a big group of collected families, where everybody was related to everybody else. Okay, so how does that then affect this issue of anonymity, or on the opposite end, intimacy between people and the level of connection that they have with one another? Right? The people of Athens were very closely connected to each other. Excuse me for a sec. Because basically, they were one big tribe of peoples. They had settled in that area, in that small region. And if you recall from the week before last, right before our break, we were talking about how Greek history got started. There was an invasion by a people called the Dorians. And the people of Athens had withstood that invasion and had not been conquered. So they were members of an extended tribe called the Ionians. I'm just going to go ahead and chat that for you guys. The people of Athens, the tribe of the Athenians, belonged to a tribe called the Ionians. And then within that tribe, well, it consisted of many clans, which basically are really large connected sets of families. So think about your family, right? You got your parents, you got the two sets of grandparents. They've got a variety of kids. I don't know how many, right? Everybody's unique in that regard. Got a certain number of cousins, certain number of second cousins. And by marriage, your family is connected in that network to other families. And you start to form this interconnected group called a clan. Nowadays, we don't focus too much on that. I mean, everybody's different. But in my family, we don't really do that. I mean, I don't feel connected to a clan so much. I mean, I'm connected to my own family and I'm connected to my wife's family. But beyond that, I don't really feel that connection too much, except sometimes when I go travel, there might be a member of our clan that would like to meet us or put us up for the night or something like that. And you know, that's kind of how modern life is. But here's how it was like and what it was like in Athens. You knew all the members of your family and you lived with them or near them. So here's the other aspect of the difference that we have to embrace in order to put ourselves back in Athens and understand how this how its history happened. Right? We just had Thanksgiving. In Thanksgiving, Americans hop on board airplanes. Why do they do that? Why is there so much air travel around Thanksgiving? And then, of course, again at Christmas time, why are we all flying all over the place? Right? And this is, again, the big difference between our life and people back then. Rosie?
They fly different places so they can visit family.
Okay, yeah, but so why is that? Why do they have to do that?
Because they don't all live in one place.
Yeah, that's just it, right? So this anonymity that we experience is related to the fact that we don't sit still anymore, right? We don't stick with our families anymore in the same town. It's just as common for people to move away from their hometown as it is to stay in it. And so we have our extended families are all very, very distant from each other. We just had Thanksgiving. We all travel from all over the place in order to be with family, and then get back to our regular lives. But this is not at all the case back in Athens. Okay, so the people of Athens were all related to each other by not too long of a chain of relationships. They were all members of a tribe. And all of the members of each family were very close. And so your household would consist of your close family, and then neighboring households would consist of your immediate, you know, their brothers and sisters and your cousins and your grandparents. And your family typically would reside in a certain district. And we're talking about hundreds of people that are related, maybe thousands, in terms of your clan and your extended relations. And you knew these people. All of the men knew each other, and the women would know each other, and they would know each other's slaves, and they knew each other's children and took care of each other and so on. And everything was really, really close-knit by comparison. And then your family, by marriage, was connected to other families. So you had your clan, and then those clans were all interconnected by marriage as well. So you've got the whole tribe. And so the point here is, who was the king to you in this setting? Right, where we have this one city, and it's not an anonymous society, this one city-state. It's not an anonymous society. Very intimately interconnected society. Everybody knows everybody else, which is exaggerated, but you know, if you meet somebody on the street in Athens, it wouldn't be long before you could figure out how closely you were connected by family. Right, and typically you would have known hundreds of people, if not thousands, by name, because this was your society. It was not an anonymous society. You were connected to everybody else very intimately. So when you get to the question of the king, here is where we have to start the story of the Athenian monarchy of its archaic history. Is that it begins with families, and it begins with interconnected families and clans and so on, and with people who all know each other. So the top family in the hierarchy in Athens were known as the Medontidae. I'm going to go ahead and type that into the chat window here. And they were the descendants of a famous hero of Athens named Medon. So that's the plural. Medontidae means descendants of Medon. And so that was one family, and it was very prominent. It was the most prestigious. It was the most, the highest, socially highest ranking family within Athens. But it would have been then connected to other families within a certain clan, and they all would have been members of the Ionian tribe. So all in some measure interconnected. And the way in which the king was chosen was from among these very high-ranking families. And he had to be a member of one of these great families, typically the Medontidae. And so you belonged to kind of an elite group of people who were considered to descend from ancient heroes of the city of Athens. And you could, you know, kind of draw your bloodline like people will do in their family trees nowadays, but you could do it orally, and you could kind of remind people of how you are descended from Medon in a certain straight line, and you could describe it. And this was a part of your identity, of your everyday walking around identity, that you were a member of a certain family. And that meant that in Athenian society, if you were among these kind of elite people, then you were known as the son of a noble father, and the word for that in Greek society was eupatrid. So the eupatrids, the Medontidae, were the highest-ranking family from among the noble families of Athens, the eupatrids. They were all Ionians. They were all related to each other, but these were families that had a specially honored bloodline because of the role that their forefathers had played in defending Athens in the Dark Ages, in the previous times, in the Dorian invasion, and so on. So the Eupatrids were considered the most worthy from among the Athenians, and it was only from their ranks that the kings were chosen. Okay, but notice what I said. I said the kings were chosen. So here we're already getting to part of the difference and one of the unique things for the Athenians. All of these noble families, everybody knew each other. They were all related. And you were expected to, you know, honor the bloodline to which you belonged, to be a Eupatrid. And so this was part of the thinking of the Athenians, that you qualified to be the king by being the son of a noble father, but, this is very important in Athenian society, you were chosen within that family line. So there was no automatic qualification in Athenian monarchy. You had to belong to the best families, but then within that family there was some level of optionality, and they would get together and they all knew each other and they would pick somebody to be the king. So already, here's where I just wanted to get to this point here in today's lecture. Notice the difference and kind of get this kind of as part of our context moving forward. The level of intimacy, the level of connectedness within the society, and the idea that a king is merely a member of an important family, not different in any essential way from anybody else, except he does have the noble bloodline. So this validates him to some extent, but not even necessarily, right? Because we know that dynasties, in many cases in history, have gone awry, have had lots of problems, because kings are not worthy of what they inherit, right? We know about this in a lot of different contexts in human life, that sons who inherit something from their fathers, whether it is power or wealth or position or something along those lines, and if they didn't earn it themselves, often fall into the trap of not being worthy of that because they didn't earn it, and losing it. And within the Greek tradition, already there's the kind of the idea that you've got to qualify in order to be the king. It's not automatic, okay? You're going to be chosen from among this noble group, but the people who know you, the people all around you, and who are also sons of noble fathers, and who are in some sense your equal, they're the ones that are going to pick. So this is already a very different arrangement than anything like we would find in ancient Egypt. You become king in Athens because you belong to this tribe and you belong to a family that's considered noble, but you qualify within that community of people who know each other to be the king as one among the possible men who are available. So already you can see an important difference here. In a close-knit society, you're going to get a different kind of king than one who's anonymous, one who automatically qualifies by birth, or one who's just one that nobody else knows, and so on, or one for whom a whole mythology of kingship has been created. No, this is a whole other setting. This is small, intimate, connected society. Everybody knows everybody else, and To be the king is merely to be an important person who's chosen to be the king. And presumably, well qualified, you've led your life, you're a noble, you yourself have proven yourself to be noble, and the people around you respect you, and they are essentially conferring an honor upon you to be the recognized chieftain for the entire tribe. All right. So that's our starting point. Now, of course, once somebody has power and somebody is the king, well, now we have the classic problem. Power corrupts. So you can get a noble person to be your king, and you choose and you can know him. But once you confer power upon him, watch out. Right? Power does what it does. And so the Athenians still had this problem. They might not have an anonymous king. They might not have somebody who's completely separate from the rest of society and whose power is kind of this strange and distant thing that people don't understand. He's known to everybody, but he still is going to have the power once he's a king. So this is going to be the problem, and we'll see that the Athenians worked this problem. They already had a certain outlook with regard to each other, and to each other as family members and connected members of the same tribe and so on. But now we're going to see that they're going to take it further. And they're going to say, all right, how can we put limitations on the king, even though he's one of us and we chose him, and he becomes, you know, this person basically who has power over our society? What else can we do to make that system more amenable to us, you know, all having the best life that we can, rather than the power corrupting the king, and then he goes on to rule us and ruin our lives? What are we going to do to make that better? All right. Well, I think that's all I needed to say for today. Like I said, hopefully my voice will be back more tomorrow. And we'll look at the first of the really important limitations that the Greeks placed on their kings, the Athenians placed on their kings, and why it wasn't enough, and then how they innovated and gradually continued to innovate in order to create an arrangement whereby their society was better ordered for each individual's freedom. Okay, thanks guys. That's going to do it for me. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye.
Bye, Mr. Faust.
Bye.
Bye.